hello there. Welcome to the On to the Next podcast. I'm your host, Alyssa, and I am so happy you are here. We are going to jump right in. I have some insanely exciting news to share. In my first episode, I talked to you about the production that my family and I have made. It's a feature film movie called 40 Before 40, written and produced by my mom, directed, and I'm also a co-star in this film as well. And we also have an amazing team in terms of post-production, during the production, cast, crew, music, sound, audio, everything like that. It has been insane. And I want to talk about it for a little bit because I need to just break down in depth how important and special this is to me, because there's lots of things that I learned from this journey as well. For starters, we are all indie, which is like independent filmmakers. This was everyone's first feature film who worked on this project, and we won a contest with Tubi and Kickstarter. So let's bring it back in, okay? Basically, my mom wrote a script loosely based off of our lives from growing up. When she was about to turn 40, my grandpa suddenly passed away, and he was only 61. And so my mom was kind of going through this midlife crisis of, what if I only have 20 years left, basically. And, you know, she lived her whole life as a family person. She was a mother, a daughter, a sister, all these things, and she didn't feel like she was fully also living for herself. She was struggling with finding herself again, because as you get older, no matter how old you are, you are always rediscovering and finding yourself. And from her story, we kind of learned she was definitely struggling with seeing what she wanted to do with herself. What was her biggest dreams? What was she feeling like she was putting on hold because she was so focused on motherhood and being a family woman? And while those things are amazing and she truly never, ever, ever lost touch with being a family woman, I do think as a woman in general, it's so easy to get lost in that. You know, you definitely can feel some guilt if you want to move and try new things and explore yourself, even as you are quote-unquote older. So she wrote this film about 40 things she wanted to do before she turned 40. Anything as simple as trying sushi for the first time, or going to a Bulls game, or getting a tattoo, whatever it is, she wanted to see what she had always hoped to do and put them on there, even the craziest of things. Some of those things were including opening up a talent agency, and she did that, and she has been doing that consistently. She even wanted to be her own, her own creator, and she's done all these things, and obviously it didn't happen overnight. It's taken more than the 1 year bucket list, but she's absolutely have done that. And I think that it's such an important thing to acknowledge that you can still do whatever you want and have your own goals and dreams, but also still be able to balance life outside of those dreams. So this movie called 40 Before 40 is about a character named Veronica, and she's kind of going through this journey. Her dad suddenly passes in the movie. She is dealing with being a mom, being a daughter, being a wife, being all of these things, and also trying to find herself and balance her own life and what she wants with it as well. We follow this character, Veronica, going through this journey of, loss, of laughs, of finding herself again. It's very much a coming-of-age movie, but which I love, because I feel like growing up, I would love watching coming-of-age movies, but I was like 13, about to turn 14, or I was 16, about to turn 17, or I was 21. Like, I feel like coming-of-age movies mostly are made for like the younger audience under like 25. And so this movie, with the lead character being almost 40, I think is a really beautiful way of showing that no matter how old you are always coming of age, and you are always finding yourself, and you are always going into new phases of life. And so this movie is a family comedy. We do see many dynamics from different points of views within the family dynamic and the family system of Veronica's. I also want to highlight how proud I am that this film was mostly a POC film. So we did tell the story from a Latina's point of view, and everyone in the family, obviously, we all come from Latin backgrounds. And being able to give so much work for people of color in the Chicagoland area, I think has also been a very big blessing, because there's not always work for us. And I think that it's very common for any POC stories to kind of be pushed to the side. And I am thankful that, every year it gets a little bit better as we as a society becomes more progressive and open. But also we do have people still who want to mute the POC's you know, voices. And so having a story so strong and powerful coming out in 2025, when the world is not the kindest to the Latin community or to POCs in general, I think is very powerful. And I do think that now could not be a better time to kind of show this story for this POV, for this family. All this to say, we did this whole journey. We filmed the movie. We did post-production, and it has been a journey, to say the least. However, I also would like to say that what we had won is this collaboration called the Filmstream Collective. So over the summer, Tubi and Kickstarter. Tubi is a free streaming platform for movies, film, television, all the things. And then Kickstarter is a place where people put, you can do fundraising off of there. So they both collabed and they decided they want to do this contest for indie filmmakers because they believe that it's important to have indie filmmakers' voices be heard and seen, and their work be seen. You know, as Hollywood and the entertainment industry, it's so common that they all stay within their own group and they don't really expand. So once you're a big dog in Hollywood, they kind of keep being a big dog, and you kind of have to just make a name for yourself or know somebody in that realm to be able to get your work be seen or to get your work on streaming platforms, for example. So we really appreciated the mission and what Tubi and Kickstarter stood for when they wanted to give different indie filmmakers all around the country, all around the world, POVs, and get their stories to be told on a platform as popular as Tubi. So it has been a great honor that we found out in early October that the 40 Before 40 movie was selected for one of the 21 movies that we put on to Tubi. And if you go on Tubi, it's a free platform streaming worldwide, and you can go on it. It's like on your Fire Stick or your Roku, wherever. I think all the like TVs, laptops, phones have that app accessible for you. You type in 40 Before 40 and we'll pop up. Or you go on the homepage, slide down to the Tubi and Kickstarter collab little section, and you can just scroll through, find the movie, and we'll be there 40 Before 40. Okay. So I also want to say a few moments to flex just so I can let it out, because I think I've been working with my therapist on like truly owning my power and my skill, because I think I so often just think like, oh, like whatever about what I do, but I do think that I do a lot that I'm proud of, and I do want to share that for a few seconds. I directed this movie. It is my first feature film that I ever directed, and I started directing this at 24 years old. And to be able to not only have the people in my world and my community and our set who believed in me to be a director at such a young age means so much to me, but to also have this film that I directed for the first time, my directorial debut, get picked, I think for me that is also very validating and very, very healing in some ways. Like, wow, like my work is being seen. Wow, like I'm really, you know, I'm proving to myself what I'm capable of. And I think that has also been a really big blessing. So I do want to thank everyone who has supported us so far in this journey. You will get annoyed from me if you follow me on social medias. I will be posting about this movie, 40 Before 40, for as long as I possibly can, because it will always be streaming. And I would just love to have people see what we did and to see that even though we are small independent filmmakers, we still made stuff happen. We used our resources. We had such a great community who was absolutely down to help us in any way. And we just feel so blessed and honored to be able to create together, tell our stories, and now have it to be somewhere that anyone can access it. So go stream the 40 Before 40 movie on Tubi. Link in all the bios, but go look her up. There's also a trailer on YouTube if you want to see what it's about first, but it's such a fun movie, all filmed in the Chicagoland area with great, great talent from all around, and we are just so proud and so honored to be a part of this, and I really, really hope and believe that this is just the beginning. So thank you for my little spiel. I will get back into other topics today, but I did want to highlight that because I have been extremely proud and excited to share this with my little community on the On to the Next podcast. So thank you for your part of my journey. Okay, I want to talk about something. I saw a quote that it was something Ariana Grande had said a couple of weeks ago in an interview while she's doing press for Wicked, and she was just talking about how she, you know, really had to embody the role of Glenda, and I think this quote, when I read it, I screenshotted it right away, got instant chills, and was like, oh my gosh, I need to talk about this on the pod. Because I think a common thing I talk about is this concept, and so I'm excited to share with you. Okay, so I am going to read this quote because I don't want to butcher it. But in these interviews, Ariana Grande was basically saying how she, you know, different ways she felt closer to Glenda. And you don't have to like Ariana Grande or Wicked or anything in this realm to appreciate this quote. So don't turn off your ears just yet. But what she had said was, I understand the struggle between trying to give people light and trying to understand where my light comes from itself. Y'all, that eats. Okay, let's dissect this. Oh my gosh, this, I can't. It took me into a frenzy when I read this because I was like, oh my gosh, you know, I talk about finding your light, not dimming your light, what to do when your light has been dimmed or when you lose your spot. Like, I talk about this all the time, and to have someone so beautifully put that into, you know, one sentence to me was just so healing and so validating. So she was basically saying, like, she knows what it's like to, you know, want to give people her light, her energy, her spirit, her soul, but also going back and reflecting on where it comes from within her. Like, I think as a human, it's so natural to give, and sometimes not even know, like, where you're pulling this energy from. And I think when you don't know where this source is coming from, this energy of yours is coming from, it's so easy to, I guess, burn out. Like, I feel like I'm someone who burns out more than I'd like to admit, because I'm always just go, or give, and I don't always give myself the time and grace that I need to, like, heal, recharge, regroup. And so having this concept of, like, needing to understand where your light comes from is so revolutionary, because I've even never thought about that. I never put it into those words. I might think, like, oh, like, I wonder, like, where I feel the most energized or with who I feel the most energized. But to think about your own light and spirit and where that comes from, I think is so precious. And it's something that you should absolutely take the time to reflect on, because as humans, life is crazy. Time is crazy. You are go. It's so easy to get wrapped up in the daily tasks where you forget what it's like to feel within yourself, to recharge, to have the energy to go back into the next things of your days, and to be able to have the people around you also be people who fuel you rather than drain you. Obviously, this is all easier said than done, but for me, once I read that quote and once I was, like, aware of that, there was, like, a light switch that turned on. And I was like, oh my gosh, I need to be able to reflect where this light is coming from within me, so that way when I'm giving it to others, I'm not losing it from myself. Because, like I said, it's so easy to give and not have enough for you as well. So that was absolutely stunning and beautiful to me, and I just loved that concept. And I'm here to give you the space to allow yourself to save some light for yourself. Don't give it all away, and give it away to people who deserve it. Don't just be throwing it out to the random Joe Schmoes of the world who do not appreciate you or your light. And that is in any setting, whether it's relationships, works, friends, family, whatever it is, be sure that you hold your light sacred to you. And from there, decide what you want to do with it and who you want to give it to. On a new topic, I have been talking with some friends, because I have a couple friends who are recently single after, like, years of being in relationships. And I also have a friend who has kind of paused in the dating world, and now, like, she's back better than ever trying to get into it. And a common theme I'm hearing from a lot of them is that they don't know how to gauge if they actually like a person, or if they just like how the person is sweet and kind and they're not used to that. And I think a common thing for girls, or for people, sorry, I guess anyone has dealt with this before, but at least in my world, a lot of my girlfriends and I really wasn't able to identify, like, what it feels like to be in a safe space or a safe relationship, sadly, because it's so common to love the highs and the lows of toxicity and the fighting and the games, the mind games, all those things. I feel like it's so easy to be used to that when you're so conditioned to being in a certain relationship or a certain headspace with someone that isn't healthy for you. And so when you get out of that and now the games are gone, there's no manipulation, it's just, you know, it's just you that you are sitting with, and now you have to take what you have had from past relationships and bring it into new spaces. And you don't realize those past things might have been negative or toxic because you were conditioned to think that was normal. And now when you bring all these, you know, past lives of you who had been in rough spaces or sad spaces or drug places or unsure, unsafe spaces with other people or with your partner from the past, it's really easy to mistake someone new who's nice and kind and, you know, open and maybe more valuable than the past have been to being boring. And like right now I have a friend and she's like, I went on a couple dates with this guy. He was super sweet, like did things for me that no one has done in just a few dates. But she still is like, I can't tell if I like him or if I'm bored or if I just feel like he's a friend because he's so nice. And I'm like, there's many layers to this. Obviously, if you don't vibe with someone, you don't vibe with someone. Or if you don't connect or feel that like flirtiness or that excitement, like that's fine. But I often think we mistake butterflies with somebody that is not good for us as like, oh my God, I'm in love. Like you think it's like so fun and cute, but when you realize later those butterflies were actually low-key anxiety because you never felt easy within yourself or with that person, or you never felt sure, when are they gonna call me next? When are they gonna text me next? When will I see them next? Do they even like me? Like all those little games like that, I feel like we are so often to condition ourselves to think like that's the way it should feel, when really you should feel ease and comfort. You should know your next move and you should know their next move. It should not be this mysterious game. And I was telling my friend, I'm like, well, for starters, this guy is like 3 years older than her, which makes him late 20s. I would hope by late 20s, men in general who are out dating are a bit more aware, emotionally mature, emotionally available, and a bit more aware of what their intentions are. So I'm like, maybe this guy, being late 20s, has some good head on his shoulders, and he's been through the, you know, the bad boy phase. He's been through the gross boy hookup. Like, he's been through all those journeys, and now he is ready for a more mature space to be in. So maybe that's why he's being so cool and so nice. And you guys know, like, I am not out here casually giving men benefit of the doubts. But she was telling me this story, and I was like, honestly, I don't think he's the problem right now. Like, he seems like a well-made human, and he seems to have a good head on his shoulders, good job. He's reliable. He shows up. He tells her what he's thinking. There's no room for her to be confused. And for her, she's like, I don't know if I like him. I'm confused. I don't know if her gut is kind of stopping her because she doesn't want to like get her hopes up and then one day he disappoints her, because I think that's very common. Also, we also are aware love bombing is a real thing. It is very easy and very common to get wrapped up in some love bombing situations and be with someone who really isn't themselves, as you know, they were showing you they were a different version of themselves as you get to know them more, or maybe even go on to date them and they aren't as love bomby-ish as they were in the beginning. So there's many things to dissect, especially if you are someone who has not been in a safe space mentally or physically or emotionally with another person. And by safe space, I don't even mean like the physical like safeness of a space. Like obviously, yes, I do, like you should be in that space, but I also mean like mental safe space, which means there's no games, there's no, you know, give or that. It's not conditional. It's not a conditional type of relationship where if you do this for me, I'll do that for you. So I feel like if you're not used to being in those spaces and then you meet people who are kind and innocent, I also find a lot of people these days are just like ready to chill and settle down. I don't know if that's just where I'm around more, because a lot of my friends are more settled down or with their person or engaged or married at this point. But I think it is common for after a certain age, especially if you are dating men a little older than you. And by a little older, I mean, like, I would say keep it within the 5-year range. But, you know, do what you think is best. But I think it's super common for men now to be like, oh my God, all my friends are engaged. Like, I need to start getting a grip. And I need to start being with someone who's also, you know, down for the long haul. So I feel like just reminding yourself when you are in those spaces where you aren't sure, don't like write someone off the first day. You also might not have showed up as your best self as well. So if you're on date two or three with somebody and you feel like there's not a good vibe, I'm not saying like, oh, what did you do wrong? Because like you do what you think you should do and you do what's best for you in the moment. But I am saying, like, were you most your most present self? Were you your most authentic self? Did you limit yourself or dim yourself because you didn't want to become too much or show a weird, quirky, different version of yourself that only your friends and family get to see? I think a rule with dating I always like to abide by for myself and those close to me was to show up as your absolute normal self. And if that's a little weird, that's a little quirky, like that's a little silly, goofy, whatever it is, like show up as that version. Obviously, like, be aware of like social surroundings and like social, like what you're around and everything, but I think that it's absolutely fair to show up as your absolute authentic self. And if someone doesn't vibe with that, then you can see to what that means, like kind of take it situation by situation. But I also think it's absolutely nothing wrong with just dating a few people at a time, kind of seeing the vibes, be safe. Or if you want to just date one person, that's amazing, date the one person, but don't mentally already like close your world off as if you can't be open to new opportunities if you guys are not exclusive or if you guys are not fully dating. This little like play around section I'm talking about right now is not like while you're fully committed to somebody, obviously. I'm saying like in the very early stages when you are still trying to find yourself and who you also like. But above all of that, I would like to say this disclaimer. Do not get it twisted. I still very much so think and believe you should not be dating to be seeking a full-time partner if you are not your best self already. And I mean that with so much love. I do believe everyone goes through ebbs and flows of life. I do believe that you absolutely can grow with someone else, or grow with someone in general and have that person as your partner, and you can change and evolve within that space. But you need to have a sure sense of identity before you go out and start dating, especially in a world that's so easy to form you and shape you. I feel like it's so easy to go on social media or go and talk to a group setting of people and they can instantly kind of change your POV on something. So if you don't have that secure sense of self, it can be scary when you're out in the dating world because you might just be saying yes to doing things that you don't want to do, that you don't know if you want to do. There's a difference between like experimenting or learning about yourself with other people compared to actually going out there and knowing you're at bare minimum, like your few non-negotiables or your few qualities you absolutely require within yourself for someone else and within someone else for you. Like, you absolutely should go out seeking with some sort of intention, even if the intention is I want to just date and mess around with whoever comes in sight, that's fine. But like, be aware of that and what that means for you, and also make those boundaries clear for yourself and for the other people when the time feels right. So I don't mean to go on this tangent, but I guess here we are. The biggest lesson of this is it is okay to accept safe experiences and love and relationships, and there is a time when you will be able to stop calling the safe thing boring, and it will actually be what you end up attracting or crave because you are used to the messiness or the toxicness of past, you know, relationships or of past things that you might have been in. But I also think above all else to be sure that you know what you want for yourself and what feels right for you before you go out and dilly-dally in this world, because you don't want to go too far off and then it's harder to get back home. Okay, do you know what I mean? So that's just a little two cents of mine. Obviously, we are learning still, we are growing, we make mistakes. Give yourself grace if you are out there and dating and trying to learn more about yourself in this dating process. Please give yourself grace, because it can be definitely daunting at times. It can be weird, it can be silly, but above all else, dating should be fun and should feel fun and should feel free. And if you ever feel like you are losing the fun in dating, then you should probably take a break, respectfully. Or you should reflect on what is not fun about it and what are ways to make things better. Is it a certain type of person that you go for? Is it a certain energy that you bring when you go on these dates? Like, there's always room to grow and adjust, and I don't think it's ever too late to change your mind or to regroup or to decide what you want and what you don't want. So lots of love, good luck, Charlie, and be safe. And also, share these stories with your friends. Talk about it. Like, don't keep it to yourself. It's more fun when you're out dilly-dallying, dating, whatever, meeting new people with friends, and or if you have stories to talk about, because I think it's important to also give other people's POVs when you are out dating, because I just don't want you to get so blind to, like, what's in front of you and think that's the only way, because that's also a very easy way to get respectfully manipulated if you don't have other POVs. Sorry, not sorry. Speaking from some experience, but also just from what I've seen throughout different people in my life's journey. Alrighty, now we are going to move on to the next topic, which is my new favorite segment called Herstory. Okay, so today for Herstory, if you are tuning in, Herstory is my new segment where I talk about an iconic woman in history and tell it from the woman's POV, and also share real life examples of how we can learn from what had happened to said woman. So, this woman I want to talk about is the one and only People's Princess. If you know, you know, it's Miss Princess Diana, or Diana Spencer, or the Princess of Wales, whatever you know her as. Princess Di, my girlie. Okay, I spent way too much time with so many documentaries with this girl. Like, I love her, and I think she is such a trailblazer. And I'm going to give you, like, a quick synopsis of what Miss Princess Di was up to and how she became this icon, essentially, for us and for just, you know, her time especially. So Princess Diana was born in a royal bloodline, but she did have a relatively, like, normal childhood. She obviously lived a privileged life, but she did have, you know, some hardships as well that kind of kept her feeling isolated, or I guess, you know, she definitely went through different phases because her parents did get divorced at a very young age, and it was really hard on her. If you don't know anything about Princess Diana, she did marry Prince Charles. So Prince Charles is the oldest son of Queen Elizabeth II. If we know Queen Elizabeth, you kind of can get an idea of what that looks like for the lineage. But basically, Prince Charles, who is now the king since the queen has passed a couple years ago, this is all the lore of them, like, before where they are now, essentially. So this is all kind of taking place roughly in, like, the 80s for context, and into the 90s. So at 13 years old, Princess Diana, before she was a princess, so Diana, told her dad that she knows she's going to marry someone famous. Talk about a manifester, okay? Sadly, the person she ended up marrying, which is, you know, Charles, wasn't really the best for her. I believe that she was dimmed a lot in her time as, you know, a wife and within the royal family. So I will say, ladies, take this as your example with manifestation. Be very specific. I know she was only 13 and she just told her dad, I want to marry someone famous. Like, she knows it within herself she was going to. But please, girlies, when you are manifesting verbally or writing stuff down to whoever, please be aware of what you say. Be so specific. Give exact, like, what's their job? Where are they from? Who are they? For whatever type of manifesting, just be specific, because this manifestation low-key ended up kind of biting Diana in the butt. And I mean that with so much love and respect. Rest in peace to my girly. Okay. So when Princess Di was 16 years old, she was out and about dilly-dallying. She was always known for having a very rambunctious, playful, joyful, just youthful energy, and very, like, in her own world. I think a lot of her childhood trauma with her parents being divorced and all of that stuff kind of kept her isolated and very alone. So that also made her really creative and kind of within herself and making up things, imaginary friends, all the things. So at 16 years old, she had an older sister who was actually dating Prince Charles at the time. Yeah, I said that correctly. So her older sister was dating Charles, who ends up becoming Princess Diana's husband. Okay. And Charles literally said in an interview that when he met Princess Diana at 16 years old, he met her as the younger sister of his girlfriend, okay? I'm trying to make this very clear. This is, like, literally what is going on here. So he met her as this younger sister, and right away he said that he gravitated towards her because she was so joyful and bouncy ew. First of all, if anyone ever calls you fucking bouncy, ew. Like, what? That's, like, a weird thing to say. Also, might I add that when he met her, not only was he the boyfriend of her older sister, but he was also 28 years old, and Diana was 16. No wonder he called her bouncy and cute and joyful and playful. Like, what is going on here, y'all? This is gross, okay? So this is already some questionable starts to this whole experience. But as we know, you know, a couple years later, Princess Diana is at a polo meeting or a polo game, and she ends up bumping into Prince Charles. They hit it off because he remembered her, obviously, as his ex-girlfriend's fucking younger sister, but whatever, he remembers her, and they end up hitting it off. A year later, they get engaged, okay? Quick turnaround for the royal family up in this bitch. So they get engaged, and right away, the media is hunting Diana down. They want to know who the new girl is that is dating the, you know, the once soon to be one day king of England. And so she, throughout her time, just really struggles with always being just so captivated by the media in a good and bad way. But for her, it was obviously very new for her because she did live a more private, independent life. So she's being hunted down throughout the media already, kind of foreshadowing to, sadly, how she ends up passing away. Spoiler alert, but also it shouldn't be because you guys should kind of know a little bit about her story, just from, like, life. But they get married, and within a few months already, Princess Diana is already seeing the abuse and the emotional and mental manipulation that occurs to her because Prince Charles, not so charming, he is a literal brat. He is self-centered, and he absolutely just thinks he runs this world. And I guess technically he does or will one day. But who cares? I don't care if you are the king or the lowest level. Like, you should treat people and women with respect. But of course, Charles is out here being a little brat. He's calling Diana chubby. He's saying things about her body, wants to get her to look like the perfect woman for him. But nothing's ever good enough. And this sends Diana down in a spiral. Spoiler alert, I will be talking about different forms of eating disorders, abuse. So take care of yourself, and you can fast forward if you don't want to listen to this. But Princess Diana, throughout her marriage with Charles, because of the way he treats her and neglects her, or if he's not neglecting her, he's being disgusting and saying such gross things to her about how she looks and, you know, just really messing up with her mental health. So she starts suffering with bulimia. And then she, throughout her journey, has this eating disorder on top of suicidal attempts. And she's just very unhappy. And she's also unhappy because throughout this journey, we learn later in life that Prince Charles was cheating on her the whole time. What a man, right, guys? What a prince. So he cheats on her from the beginning, you know, basically very early on, with one of his long-term friends, Camilla. Camilla is closer to him in age, so at least he'd got that right this time around. But still rude and disrespectful. Princess Diana even went on air in interviews, talking to the BBC, y'all. BBC, that is, this girl did not hold back. She was on the biggest news platform for the British people, and she fully told them in an interview that there were three of us in that relationship, referring to herself, her husband, and his mistress, Camilla. Okay. Yes, this is very common, unfortunately, especially in the royal families, where the king or the prince is able to have a million different girls, but the princess or the queen has to remain loyal to their one. However, Princess Diana was like, it is the 80s, y'all. Like, I'm not doing this. So she was getting just berated by the royal family. They were trying to silence her. Keep in mind, throughout this journey, they also have two young boys together. So Princess Diana, despite everything she was going through, her focus was always motherhood and her sons. And she always wanted to make sure her sons were protected. And while it's so hard to balance all of that, obviously she had help from her staff and whatever, but like, she always took in pride of being a mother before anything. Her royal duties, her appearances, whatever it is, always came second when it came to her boys. So she tried to be present for her sons, all while dealing with a really, really toxic and sad and isolating marriage. And also while dealing with all these pressures that not only the royal family is putting on her, but the media. Like when Queen Elizabeth II heard that she said there were three of us in this marriage, she was like, that is it. You're done. Let's cut her off. And they tried to silence her. And they tried and they tried many, many times. But Princess Diana knew she was done. And within a few years, I think it was about 7 or 8 years later into the marriage, she decides it is finally time for a divorce. Okay? This girl was ahead of her times. You were not out there getting divorces, especially in the royal family. That was unheard of. Okay? So finally, Princess Diana's like, I want a divorce. You are horrible, and I can't be with you anymore. And it literally was ruining her soul, her spirit, her light, okay? So she decided she needed to walk away. She also, at the same time, agrees to do an interview, very in-depth interview, to tell her story. And there is a journalist who ended up becoming an author and published a book called Diana, Her Side of the Story. And this journalist and author, Andrew Morton, interviewed Princess Diana in depth. In depth, to every little detail. Like, you do not do this in the royal family. And she was like, I don't care. She's doing what she wants. Talk about a trailblazer. Talk about a woman who will not be silenced for any longer. And she did this interview. And they published a book called Diana, Her True Story. Okay. And this, once that came out, Queen Elizabeth was like, we are done. You better be getting a divorce. She was triggered. Queen Elizabeth was like, nobody comes in my castle and ruins my name or my family's name. But Princess Di was like, I'm doing whatever I want. And she's claiming her power back. I also would like to mention, throughout her journey, one of the big issues that Prince Charles could not handle was the fact that Diana naturally gravitated towards the light, okay? Diana was loved. She was called the People's Princess. Like, she was known, she was iconic, a fashion icon, a philanthropist, an activist, a humanitarian. She was all of these things outside of, obviously, being a mother and a part of the royal family, but she took so much pride in that. She stood her ground. She was someone who made all of her people, all of the fans, and the community within their world feel so loved and seen. And Prince Charles hated how much she was loved. He hated that in that marriage, she was a star. He wanted to be the star. And I'm sick and tired of another weak man not being able to handle being with a star. He was trying to dim Diana, and he had dimmed her for years, but she was done, and she was not going to let this happen for any longer. So she does the interview, she gets a divorce, and she is back better than ever. Obviously, for the sake of time and this story, I am cutting out a lot of the gruesome, sad details of what Diana went through mentally, but I do think it is very important to acknowledge this was not easy for her. And while, yes, we can see her as this symbol of feminism and icon and of being a strong woman and of knowing when to walk away, but it is important to realize there were lots of trials and tribulations before this, you know, official ending for her had occurred, before she fully left essentially the royal family, because she kind of was like leaving this man, and her sons were the only thing kind of keeping her within that world still. But I do would like to say, go look her up, because you will definitely learn so much more if you hear her side of the story, not what the media or the royal family wants you to know, because they definitely still try to silence her even after years of her essentially passing away. So after the divorce, she is for the first time free. She's lived her life, and she wants to take time and retire from the public eye at only 32 years old. And she wanted to focus on being a mother and protecting her kids, because more than ever, after all of this lore happening, the media, the press, paparazzis were not leaving her alone. Princess Diana's brother even came and spoke at her funeral and said that she was the most hunted woman or hunted person of that time, because that was the modern age for them. Like, in the 80s, the 90s, like, that was just when the paps and everything was becoming a lot more in your face and more ruthless. And Princess Diana didn't really have people from the past that she could kind of learn from. Like, I feel like in the 2000s, when we had all of this stuff happening with Britney Spears and Lindsay Lohan and Paris Hilton and the Kardashians and the paparazzis and all this stuff, like, there are laws now that are made to keep some sort of safety for, you know, these celebrities and these public figures who are getting swarmed by the paparazzi. But this wasn't a thing back then. And sadly, Diana's story is what kind of started the conversation of how unsafe it is to be in the public eye, because even though it's beautiful and there's so much love and light and responsibility in a good way that you have with that public figure platform, the paparazzis was essentially the reason why Diana had passed away. And there are many conspiracies on her death, but I would like to say between 32 and 36 years old, she lived what we see to be a much happier, freer, good life. She did have a new boyfriend. He was someone who was creative and in the entertainment industry and from a wealthy family, and she was able to travel, and she was known for the iconic, you know, pictures on the yacht and the revenge dress. Look it up if you know, you know. Like, this girl was out better than ever trying to live her best life with her two boys and just whatever the world had given to her. It's so heartbreaking knowing that she did pass away suddenly, unexpectedly at 36 years old. It genuinely still, like, breaks my heart when I see her, because I'm just like, Princess Diana would have lived for the Gen Zs. She would have lived for her son, Prince Harry, marrying Meghan Markle. Like, going out of the box, marrying someone that he loves, even though she's not what, you know, the royal family wanted for her for many different reasons. Like, Diana literally walked so Harry could run. Like, and not only Harry, like, all these women that she had impacted. She also was such a beautiful activist for the queer community. She was the first woman out there shaking people who had AIDS their hands during the AIDS pandemic in the 80s. Like, she was out there not caring and just making sure that she spreaded her mission of loving people and of people being kind to one another, despite all that she was dealing with inside. So I think that there are many, many lessons we can learn from Princess Diana. It's so heartbreaking knowing that she only had 36 years to make her mark, but she made her mark and her legacy still continues. So as a woman, as someone who is a trailblazer in your space, please know that you can take up that space. You can say no. You can walk away from spaces that are not good for you. You can trust your gut and do what is best for you. And if and the moment it is safe, get out if you need to and speak up, and you absolutely can reinvent yourself and find yourself time and time again. If there's one thing that we learned from Princess Diana is that you can always reinvent yourself, be fun, be playful, laugh, smile, and live your best life, because thankfully, you know, because you never know how long you will get. So I'm going to end there, my little herstory segment. Lots of love to Princess Diana. May she rest in peace. I hope she is watching over her family and her sons, and I hope she is absolutely proud of what, you know, their family has come of. But I also hope that we, as people who are consumers and, you know, people who love Princess Diana, can also learn a lot from her story and also rewrite that narrative of what the royal family or Prince Charles wants you to think. So, it has been a journey. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being a part of this. I would like to say one last time, shameless plug, go watch the 40 Before 40 movie on Tubi, stream for free worldwide. And please continue to submit those questions and ask about topics and different things. Send me some herstory women that I can look into more and talk about. And as always, tell your friends, tell the girls, tell the boys, tell the grandmas, tell the grandpas, your mom, your dad, whoever, about the On to the Next podcast. And please, please, please take care of yourself. Lots of love. I will see you in the next episode. Bye.